Today is Friday, November 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the second day of public hearings in U.S. President Donald Trump's impeachment inquiry gets underway.
Ambassador Yovanovitch was tough on corruption. Too tough on corruption for some, and her principled stance made her enemies.
But how are the proceedings shaping public opinion? And violent protests continue in Hong Kong, plus what may be the impact of U.S.-Chinese trade deal? Those stories and more are all coming up next. The former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine says she watched in disbelief as her reputation was publicly sullied in a campaign to discredit her. She was ousted from her job, even as her boss assured her she had done nothing wrong. Today, diplomat Marie Yovanovitch is speaking publicly about her treatment by U.S. President Donald Trump's administration. Yovanovitch, a career diplomat, had been in the spotlight Friday as the lone witness on the second day of public impeachment hearings in the U.S. House of Representatives. House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff characterized Yovanovitch in this way.
In her time in Kiev, Ambassador Yovanovitch was tough on corruption. Too tough on corruption for some, and her principled stance made her enemies. As George Kent told this committee on Wednesday, you can't promote principled anti-corruption action without pissing off corrupt people. And Ambassador Yovanovitch did not just piss off corrupt Ukrainians, like the corrupt former Prosecutor General Yuri Lutsenko, but also certain Americans, like Rudy Giuliani, Donald Trump's personal attorney, and two individuals now indicted who worked with him.
Republican ranking member Devin Nunes responded by criticizing the impeachment process.
These hearings should not be occurring at all until we get the answers to three crucial questions the Democrats refuse to ask. First, what is the full extent of the Democrats' prior coordination with the whistleblower, and who else did the whistleblower coordinate this effort with? Second, what is the full extent of Ukraine's election meddling against the Trump campaign? And third, why did Burisma hire Hunter Biden? What did he do for them? And did his position affect any government actions under the Obama administration?
In her opening statement, Yovanovitch highlighted her fight on corruption.
As the past couple of months have underlined, not all Ukrainians embraced our anti-corruption work. Thus, perhaps it was not surprising that when our anti-corruption efforts got in the way of a desire for profit or power, Ukrainians who preferred to play by the old corrupt rules sought to remove me. What continues to amaze me is that they found Americans willing to partner with them, and working together, they apparently succeeded in orchestrating the removal of a U.S. ambassador. How could our system fail like this? How is it that foreign corrupt interests could manipulate our government? Which country's interests are served when the very corrupt behavior we have been criticizing is allowed to prevail?
President Trump took to Twitter as Yovanovitch testified, saying that everywhere she went in her diplomatic career turned bad. When how that tweet made her feel, she said it was intimidating. Committee Chairman Adam Schiff called the tweet witness intimidation. Also Friday, Trump released a summary of his first phone call to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in April. The partial memo indicates that corruption and former Vice President Joe Biden were not discussed. Trump's later phone call to Zelensky on July 25th prompted the current impeachment process after a whistleblower alerted superiors about his concerns that Trump acted improperly in trying to persuade the Ukrainian president to investigate Biden and his son Hunter, who sat on the board of a Ukrainian gas company. Democrats hope the hearings will sway public opinion to support their case against the president, who they say improperly withheld aid to push the Ukrainian government to attack his political rival. Republicans are counting on an aggressive defense to move the public to oppose impeachment, which they call a partisan attack on a president trying to investigate corruption. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more on the political stakes in the impeachment battle from Washington.
Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you are about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
Two veteran U.S. diplomats, George Kent and William Taylor, were front and center as the impeachment hearings began. Taylor said the White House held back military aid to Ukraine for a time as part of a pressure campaign by the president to demand investigations into rival Joe Biden.
To withhold that assistance for no good reason other than help with the political campaign made no sense.
Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff said that alleged conduct fits the constitutional standard of high crimes and misdemeanors that warrants impeachment.
Is this what Americans should now expect from their president? If this is not impeachable conduct, what is?
Republicans said the witness testimony about the president's actions was second and third hand, and that Ukraine eventually got the military aid. Congressman Devin Nunes said the impeachment inquiry is part of a long-standing Democratic plot to bring down the president.
Anyone familiar with the Democrats' scorched earth war against President Trump would not be surprised to see all the typical signs that this is a carefully orchestrated media smear campaign.
Trump has repeatedly said the Democrats have no case.
There's never been a president who's been so transparent. This is a witch hunt at the highest level, and it's so bad for our country.
Democrats hope that the televised hearings will build public support for their case against the president, says legal analyst Susan Lowe Block.
This is not a situation where the House and the Senate would remove someone because they don't like him. That would be wrong, and that's not what is at issue here. But it is also, at the same time, a political process that has to have the public behind them.
Public opinion polls show the country remains deeply split on the impeachment issue, says analyst Ramesh Ponuru.
I think it remains to be seen what impact impeachment is going to have on the 2020 election. Right now, it is just solidifying the opinions of supporters of each party.
As the hearings move on, Democrats will need to build a bipartisan case for impeachment, says analyst John Fortier.
For a president to be removed means that both parties, a significant part of both parties, have to agree to that. And so I think for Democrats, they're going to want to see a lot more movement in public opinion. Maybe that will happen over the course of investigation, but it certainly hasn't moved tremendously.
I have never been a quitter.
Richard Nixon resigned the presidency in 1974 when his support plummeted in public opinion polls.
I want it to be legal without being particularly helpful.
Bill Clinton survived a Senate impeachment trial in 1999 when much of the public rejected Republican efforts to remove him from office. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Also Friday, Roger Stone, a longtime friend and ally of President Donald Trump, was found guilty of witness tampering and lying to Congress about his pursuit of Russian-hacked emails damaging to Hillary Clinton's 2016 election bid. Stone was convicted of all seven counts in an indictment that accused him of lying to Congress, tampering with witnesses, and obstructing the House investigation into whether the Trump campaign coordinated with Russia to tip the 2016 election. He is the sixth Trump aide or advisor to be convicted of charges brought about as part of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. Stone has denied wrongdoing and consistently criticized the case against him as politically motivated. He did not take the stand during his trial, and his lawyers did not call any witnesses as his defense. Scheduling was sentenced for February 6th for Stone's sentence, and he could face up to 20 years in prison. The president of Hong Kong's Chinese university, which anti-government protesters have turned into a fortress stockpiled with gasoline bombs and bows and arrows, threatened on Friday to call in assistance unless all non-students leave. Students and protesters have barricaded at least five campuses after 4 days of some of the worst violence in the former British colony for decades. This student protester told VOA their actions were more than just about protecting themselves.
We're here to tell you, we know exactly what we are doing here. Despite the fact that this, you know, the barricades or the rocks, this equipment is just for our own protection. You have seen the police brutality in Hong Kong. They are trying to attack welfare, not only the people who participate in the demonstration, but also the one of the pedestrians just walking around the streets. How can you tolerate that?
The week has also been marked by intensification of the violence. A 70-year-old street cleaner who had been hit in the head by one of several bricks police said had been thrown by masked rioters died on Thursday. And on Monday, police blamed a rioter for dousing a man with gasoline and then setting him on fire. That victim is still in critical condition. Hong Kong also sank into recession for the first time in a decade for the third quarter. Government economist Andrew Au.
Quarter to quarter, after seasonal adjustment, real GDP contracted significantly by 3.2%, the second decline in a row, indicating that the economy has already entered a recession. External demand weakened further in the third quarter due to slackening global demand and escalated U.S. mainland trade tensions.
I'll also place some of the blame for the economic downturn on the increasingly violent anti-government protests. But there may be some good news on the global economic horizon. White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow on Thursday said that the U.S. and China were getting close to an agreement and were talking every day. Kudlow described the mood as pretty good and acknowledged that things haven't always been that way during the talks. Hopes of a trade deal between Washington and Beijing turned world stock markets and other risk assets higher Friday. Europe's main bursaries followed Asia and Wall Street higher and higher. Now to take a closer look at the impact of Sino-U.S. trade dispute, I spoke with Dr. C. Fred Bergston at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
The U.S.-China trade dispute has evolved into the world's first real trade war since the 1930s. It has led to a back-and-forth imposition of tariffs between the U.S. and China on an ever-escalating amount of trade, now threatened to reach $500 billion in terms of U.S. imports and well over $100 billion in terms of U.S. exports. As a result, trade in both directions between the two countries has dropped by double-digit amounts between 12 and 20% over the course of 2019 to date. That has damaged both economies. Growth has slowed down in both economies. Uncertainty has been generated and retarded investment in both economies. So it's a lose-lose proposition all around. There's an effort now to reach a settlement on at least part of the disputes and we roll back at least part of the tariff increases, but we're a long way from a solution, and so the problem festers over both the U.S. economy and the world economy as a whole.
Speaking of uncertainty, when we have periods where discussions seem to be backsliding or on hold, the markets around the world seem to dip. And then when there are statements like the deal may be imminent and things look good, we see the markets uptick. What's been the impact on this oscillating cycle, you know, this uncertainty on the global markets who are carefully watching events transpire?
The markets do respond very sharply in the short run to news about the trade dispute. When it looks like the tariffs are going up further, the markets dip. When it looks like a settlement might be on the way, the markets rise. But those are very short-term reactions. The markets have been in a very steady uptrend over the last several years. They're hitting new highs as we speak today. And so superimposed over these short-term gyrations, there's been a steady uptrend. I suspect the uptrend would have been even greater in the absence of the trade conflict.
Dr. C. Fred Bergston is Senior Fellow and Director Emeritus at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Thank you very much for your time today.
Glad to do it.
And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
In 1929, Edwin Hubble, astronomer and namesake of the famous space telescope, provided evidence that the universe was expanding. To determine the rate of expansion, Hubble came up with a unit of measurement called the Hubble constant. Initially, Hubble estimated the universe was expanding at a rate of 500 kilometers per second per megaparsec. A megaparsec is equal to about 3.26 million light years. Over the years, astronomers have lowered estimates of the Hubble constant down to between 50 and 100 kilometers per megaparsec. Astrophysicists from Clemson University recently used new techniques and data from the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope and the Imaging Atmospheric Cherenkov Telescopes to determine the Hubble constant. They estimate the universe is expanding at a rate of nearly 67.5 kilometers per second per megaparsec. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. U.S. Secretary of Defense Mark Esper pressed South Korea on Friday to pay more for the cost of stationing U.S. troops in the country and to maintain an intelligence-sharing pact with its other Asian ally, Japan, that Seoul is about to lapse. Now, to take a deeper look at the cost-sharing agreement, its logistics, and what it means for the region, I spoke with Harry Kazianis, Senior Director at the Center for the National Interest. Harry, can I get you to put into perspective the notion that the Trump administration has been asking for South Korea to pay more for the troop sharing costs for the service members that are there? What does that mean in terms of the U.S.-ROK alliance?
Well, I don't think anybody's shocked at looking at this from the perspective of the campaign promises that Trump made in 2016. One of the things that Donald Trump promised was to realign our alliances. And that meant really shifting the burden to allies like South Korea, Japan, our European partners, to essentially pay more for the common defense, whether that's troop levels, basing, military equipment, forces that get rotated in and out of those areas. So that is not shocking. What is shocking is how much Donald Trump wants from South Korea, which is about somewhere around $4 to $5 billion. That is a tremendous sum of money to ask from South Korea, and it almost smacks as if Donald Trump is trying to use Seoul as essentially an example that he will make to other countries, specifically Japan, which basing arrangements and contracts are coming up in the near future, as well as Europe in the years to come. And it is fracturing the alliance. It is causing damage.
You mentioned troops rotating in and out for the common defense. What specifically is the goal of having U.S. troops on the peninsula? Is it just a safeguard against North Korea?
Well, we only have 28,000 troops in South Korea. We have, I think it's less than one division of tanks. It isn't a tremendous amount of firepower. But what it does is it is essentially what we call in political science a tripwire. In other words, if North Korea were ever to attack South Korea or U.S. troops in South Korea, that would activate the U.S.-South Korea alliance, and essentially North Korea knows that it would be at war with the United States. And I think to request for South Korea to essentially pay for every part of the alliance is quite frankly absolutely ridiculous. And I think what people need to understand is why the United States is a superpower is not because of our, you know, military might. It is because of these alliance networks that the United States has. And when you start ripping away at that fabric, people are going to start questioning our validity as a superpower, and that's a big problem.
Harry Kazianis is a senior director at the Center for the National Interest. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Lebanon's uprising shows no signs of abating since it started last month, but the country's political leadership seems to continue to bank on protesters running out of steam. The perseverance and multi-generational aspect of the uprising have left the politicians in shock. Experts say, despite their shock, the country's leaders are not acting to reform a sectarian political system and a collapsing economy. Paul Salem, director of the Middle East Institute, spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi about what is next for Lebanon and whether empty promises could send protesters home.
No, I think we are in the first months of a crisis that might go on for many months. It's become clear that the ruling class is not in a hurry to make any changes to the government they make will be very limited. The protesters, which is really more and more taking on the aspect of a broad revolution, is really fed up with the whole ruling system and the whole ruling class, and is getting more extreme and is not going to settle for small changes or small compromises. So I think we're in for a long standoff between a corrupt ruling class which wants to hold on to its privileges and which is very aware that if they give up power, they might end up in jail, and the population which is very fed up with the situation.
So would the continuous uprising lead eventually to serious change in the political system in Lebanon?
That is very, very hard to predict. First of all, there's going to be a period of crisis, and there will be alongside that a serious economic decline, economic crisis, which will be very painful both for the government, the ruling class, as well as the population.
How did the failure of the ruling class to respond lead to the looming economic crisis in Lebanon?
The economic crisis is not the result of this particular political standoff. It's quite the reverse, that the economic crisis was beginning in the country, and that is largely what drove wide sectors of the population onto the streets. The economy is shrinking. It was harder and harder to get money out of the banks. The currency was about to collapse. So much of the protest is in reaction to the mismanagement and corruption of the ruling class, which led to the beginning of an economic crisis, but the crisis is likely to get worse in the weeks forward.
So what's the way out of the current Lebanese crisis?
Well, the way out would be the appointment of an independent government, not partisan, a government of technocrats who are independent and credible, who can regain the confidence of the population, and equally importantly, regain the confidence of the international community. Lebanon is not going to avoid a massive economic collapse without support from countries in the West as well as countries in the Gulf. And this current government and this current ruling class has completely lost the confidence of that international community. So a new independent government would be the most immediate step. And then the holding of early elections for parliament so that the people can review their choices of representatives and elect new people.
So would the crisis increase or decrease the influence of Hezbollah?
It depends how Hezbollah acts and how Hezbollah handles the situation. It has already lost a lot of sort of political support from wide sectors of the population. It is blamed for a lot of the economic and political situation we're in. And even for the first time within the Shiite community, you have protesters standing up and criticizing Hezbollah for the very first time. It's not at all as severe as the situation in Iraq, but it is the first time it's happened in Lebanon. So Hezbollah is in a crisis itself, but it is not under any direct threat of anything major happening. But it would need to find a way out of this crisis, particularly for its own community, which is very affected by economic troubles.
And that was the director of Middle East Institute, Paul Salem, speaking to VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi. Qantas has completed what could one day be the world's longest commercial flight. Passengers on a Boeing 787 Dreamliner spent more than 19 hours up in the air in a research flight from London to Sydney. Passengers and crew were monitored throughout the journey to see how humans fared on the ultra-long-haul flight. It's being called Project Sunrise. CEO Alan Joyce marveled at having seen a double sunrise on the flight and said the design of the plane would help combat the fatigue of long journeys. It could be a game changer for the Australian airline. Analysts forecast nonstop flights from Sydney to London and New York could add over $120 million to annual profits if the company charges a premium for cutting out a stopover. Qantas has yet to place an order for the planes capable of the flight. Even if they do, the first commercial flight wouldn't be until 2023. And that's going to do it for us today and this week. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Dan Brown, engineer Thomas Blondet, and managing editor Kate Pound Dawson, thank you very much for joining us. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news at the VOA News website. And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great weekend. We'll be right back.